Yeah. Let's get started, Alex, with what's going on right now in Venezuela. I know you know well what's going on there. How can you describe what's going on and what has happened there?
Well, what happened is a very typical thing that Venezuela held presidential elections on 28th July, so 2 days ago, and the Venezuelan people elected the wrong candidate. And so, the whole network of the US State Department and various NGOs and the Western media jumped in to correct the mistake. And we have something that resembles the Euromaidan from 10 years ago, almost. And so now I can't really tell you what's going on in Venezuela because the news flow, not just through the mainstream media, but also through the social media, are full of disinformation, psyops and fake news. So we see a lot of videos that were, from 2017, and I think that there are protests, but they're probably I would wager that the situation is a little bit less tense than what we are being led to believe. But the event is a very typical US Western orchestrated regime change operation, which typically gets triggered after elections. What you have is Western-sponsored polling organizations that will publish that, oh, according to the exit polls, the elections were a fraud because Maduro won, and you have this what's it called? Erickson Research. Who said that no, the Gonzalez, Leopoldo Gonzalez, should have won because he was going to get 65% of the vote, and Maduro only 31% of the vote, and so therefore the elections were illegitimate. Maduro lost the election. Immediately you get trigger of all the NGOs. In Venezuela you get U.S. State Department to issue a statement. You get various other, opinion leaders and influencers who issue statements, including Donald Trump and people like Elon Musk, and then they start encouraging the people to pour out into the streets to protest and hope to effect a regime change and new elections. This is exactly what happened, for example, in Georgia in 2003, right? The US guy, Mikhail Saakashvili, was going to challenge the sitting president, Edward Shevardnadze, right? And Saakashvili lost the election. But they claimed again, according to exit polls, that Shevardnadze stole the election. And then the NGO got all the people to pour out into the streets. And after about 20 days of protests, Shevardnadze resigned. And then there was another election in January 2004, and Mikhail Saakashvili was helped by a variety of American election, engineers, and then he won the January 2004 election with a 96% margin. The fact that it's never about democracy, really, is that what happened after the 2004 elections in Georgia?
Yeah, we have
My
Alex.
apologies. Something went wrong, and I have to join you using a telephone.
No problem at all.
So I got cut off, but basically what I was saying is that the elections are never really about democracy in these cases. They're always about some eventual agenda, which in case of Georgia was arming Georgia to become a bludgeon in Russia, against Russia. Mikhail Saakashvili boosted Georgia's defense spending 8 times, from 1% of the GDP to 8% of the GDP. And then by 2008,
He mobilized fully half of Georgia's army to launch a war against Russia. In case of Venezuela, obviously, it's about regional hegemony, and it's about dominating Venezuela's oil resources. So it's not about whether the elections were fair. It's an opportunity to effect a regime change operation. So I think that this is what the powers that be in the United States and in the West are trying to achieve. Now, having said that, you know, a lot of these plans have failed lately. Namely, you know, in Belarus, in Kazakhstan, in Kyrgyzstan, I believe, and elsewhere. Because I think that the states around the world are wisening up to these plans and these schemes to effect color revolutions and regime changes. And if I were to make a prediction, I would predict that Venezuela will probably be able to fight off this regime change attempt.
When you look at the way that Elon Musk and Milei from Argentina, they're talking about the situation in Venezuela, in your opinion, what's behind this type of attitude that they're having right now? Why Elon Musk is doing this, in your opinion?
Well, I think that all of these people, the people close to the seat of power, represent, I think, ultimately the financial interest, or at the very least, they have to pretend that they are favorable to the financial interest. And I have to explain this because it's not obvious. These link-ups are not advertised; they're deliberately hidden. But you know, we also saw Donald Trump say, like, "Oh, you know, when I was the president, Venezuela was close to collapsing, and it would have collapsed, and we would have taken all that oil." What does it mean to say we would have taken all that oil? It's not like the United States is going to come in and take the oil for free. It's going to be Western corporations who are going to come in, like Exxon, Shell, BP, companies of that sort. They're going to come in. They're going to ramp up oil production back to whatever, 2.5-3 million barrels a day, which had collapsed in the meantime due to U.S. sanctions. To at one point in 2020, I think less than 500,000 barrels a day, and now it's still less than 1 million barrels a day. And the relevant part to understand is that all of these corporations could equally just buy Venezuelan oil from PDVSA, Petróleos de Venezuela, right, which is producing the oil. The interest group that is most interested in controlling the Venezuelan resources are the banking establishment. So we can call it, you know, Citigroup, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, banks like this. The reason why controlling Venezuelan oil resources is interesting for them is because this is money, good collateral that would allow them to issue loans to these corporations that would then go into Venezuela and develop the oil resources. And then, you know, gradually the standard deal take over most of Venezuela's economy. This is who gains everything. You know, while oil corporations could just buy Venezuelan oils, the bankers gain no advantage. And so, you know, this is the power in the shadows. And so if you go against this power, the likelihood is you're not going to be long for political life in the United States. So I don't know whether people like Elon Musk and Trump are sincere in what they're saying, because remember, Donald Trump also was saying, "Oh yeah, we're staying in Syria for their oil." I think that the reason they're doing this is because they want the powers that be, meaning the financial cartel, the international financial cartel, to support them, to give them the benefit of the doubt, to not eliminate them To Trump's credit, if I may say so, you know, it's a dubious credit, but I would entertain the possibility. When Trump was in power, he assigned Venezuela to two of the biggest flunkies in his deep state, and they were John Bolton and Elliot Abrams. And Elliot Abrams is really truly a flunky. He's become nobody in the U.S. political establishment. And John Bolton himself, Trump himself, said that he was the dumbest man he had ever met. So it seems to me that maybe Donald Trump wanted to play along, show intent to take over Venezuela, to regime change it. But he actually made a very feeble attempt, and he assigned the case to, you know, demonstrably incapable people. I think we have the same today, probably, or maybe at least likely. They have to play along with this game because the financial establishment is far, far too powerful to say, like, no, we're not going to regime change Venezuela. We're going to stay out of this, and we're just going to simply do business with them and buy their oil from them in an open market. This won't fly in today's political environment. So I suspect that they're not sincere. About Milei, I couldn't say, because to me, Milei almost doesn't occupy the same planet as I do. I don't understand him. I think he's the puppet in the hands of the very same financial interest as is everybody else. And I think that his entire pattern of conduct slowly over time confirms that he really is a puppet on the strings by the Wall Street and the City of London.
We know that people in Venezuela are not happy with the economy of the country, which is a product of tremendous sanctions for years on Venezuela's economy. And how did these sanctions destroy the Venezuela's economy, in your opinion?
Well, you know, Venezuela lost access to international markets. They're practically under an embargo. They lost access to credit, to financial credit, to develop their economy. And they are under some of the heaviest sanctions ever inflicted up until that point against any country. You know, now Russia is suffering under worse sanctions. But this was really heavy-handed, to the point that Venezuela's oil production collapsed because they could no longer procure equipment, replacement pieces for their production of oil and extraction, and also their refining capacity collapsed. The GDP collapsed by something like 75%. Government's revenues collapsed by something allegedly close to 99%, so that after 2017, Venezuela's state continued to operate on something like 1% of their pre-sanctions revenue. So, of course, you know, this is going to destroy the economy. Now, I see a lot, you know, like in the social media, I see a lot of commentary saying, like, oh, no, no, it's not the sanctions that destroyed the Venezuelan economy, it's socialism. Because, you know, socialism is such a handy word to, you know, dismiss a nation's government, to accuse them of incompetence, of giving away free stuff to the people to keep them happy and so forth. But the reality is that Venezuelan economy collapsed under the weight of sanctions. And I used to live in Venezuela before Hugo Chavez ever came to power, and before Venezuela was under sanctions and under a socialist government. And so Venezuela at the time was I lived there in 1993 and 1994, when you had very much capitalist government in charge, who was very friendly with the United States, and U.S. corporations were practically having a free hand running Venezuela. And the economy wasn't doing great. 80% of the people in Venezuela were under the poverty line, and I worked there, and I had colleagues who were illiterate. I was shocked about that, but they were, grown-up people who didn't know how to read and write. And you know, the law and order, because now they say like, oh, law and order collapsed under this socialist government. But law and order had collapsed a long time ago under the colonial rule, you know, because this was typical colonial rule over Venezuela by the United States. And I remember very well that every Monday morning, the national hobby was reading the newspapers, and the front page of the newspapers would show how many people were killed in Caracas over the weekend. And they were counting only gunshot and knife stabbings, gunshot wounds and knife fatal stabbings. And the lowest number that I remember was in the high teens, maybe like 18 people killed over the weekend. And the highest number was something over 130. But every single weekend in Caracas, dozens of people were killed. I was instructed never to stop at the red light when driving through Caracas after 8 o'clock in the evening. So it's not like Venezuela was okay before Chavez and before socialist governments, and now it fell apart because of socialism. No, it was a mess before. Chavez was a reaction to this. And the socialist government now that is trying to change the course in Venezuela is now being crushed with sanctions. And I think we need to be fair about that. It's not about socialism. It's about the fact that the global hegemon wants to control Venezuela's oil resources, which are allegedly the largest in the world. And the United States political and military establishment want to wrest control over those resources on behalf of the global banking establishment. I think that's the reality, and this is why we see this conflict now.
Washington Post reported that more than one-third of the countries on the planet are sanctioned by the United States. And when it comes to Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, these countries that even Russia are under huge sanctions coming from the West, what BRICS can do, in your opinion, in the near future, in the short term and long term, to improve the situation in these countries?
Well, I think they just have to continue doing what they have been doing, and this is developing direct trade relationships between countries on a bilateral basis. So rather than trading and using Western financial system to affect payments, they just use their own national currency to pay for that trade directly. And we see that, you know, Russia and China are developing systems to facilitate that trade. I think some time ago they were planning to design an alternative to the US dollar, an alternative reserve currency that would be commodity backed. But I think it seems to me by reading various papers written by people like Sergei Glazyev that for the time being they have given up on this idea because it isn't strictly speaking necessary, and the same development can be done by simply using each country using its own currency. And so I think that this is already a growing trend. If we look at where we were 20 years ago, the United States was the main trade partners to most countries in the world. Today, this is no longer the case. It's China, and it's increasingly India and Russia, and increasingly countries are trading directly one with the other. And they're being helped. They're getting help from China, particularly. And I think that this trend will continue. And the sanctions, as a weapon, as a means of applying pressure, are losing their effectiveness. And we can see that perfectly with the sanctions against Russia. Not only did they not collapse Russian economy, but Russian economy is doing better than any of the Western countries by What they so far this year, Russia's economy has grown 5%. None of the Western economies come even close to that. And so, given the nuclear sanctions that were applied to Russia, the fact that their economy would be thriving today is simply proof positive that the sanctions are no longer working and people are no longer intimidated by them.
Alex, do you understand what's going on right now in the European Union? We know that Zelensky talked with Donald Trump. It seems that he wants to have some sort of political settlement. But behind the scene, you see Europeans are totally, it seems to me, against any sort of political settlement. They're trying to convince Zelensky to do what he has been doing for more than 2 years.
Yes, I think that we've been getting very mixed signals coming out of Ukraine. It appears that Zelensky has a few weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago or so, he has given a statement in which he dropped the preconditions for talks with Russia, that he expressed willingness to concede territorial gains to Ukraine's detriment to stop the war. I think that they are a little bit panicked by the prospect of Biden no longer being there and by Donald Trump coming to the US presidency again, because they believe that not only will the United States cease their support for Ukraine, which will spell game over for Volodymyr Zelensky's government, but that they will also cease their support of NATO. They will. You know, they Trump made it pretty clear that he does not intend to support NATO in their war effort in Ukraine. So I think that there's a sense of panic, but at the same time you have this let's call it neoconservative element that wants to prevail against Russia at all cost, and at the very least inflict as much damage to Russia as possible, which means that they can't hand Russia over a victory. So they're ready to fight Russia to the very last Ukrainian, to very last volunteer from anywhere that is willing to enter the meat grinder. And so any talk of peace is unwelcome. And we saw Ursula von der Leyen when she took over the presidency of the EC, European Commission, for another 5 years. She gave a very shocking speech in the European Parliament, in which she accused Viktor Orban for and his peace mission, because Viktor Orban, as soon as Hungary took over the rotating presidency of the EU, Viktor Orban first went to Kiev, he went to China, he went to Russia, and he went to visit Donald Trump because he wants the war to stop. He wants the killing to stop. Hungary shares a border with Ukraine. This is a very serious potential source of instability for Hungary. So it's understandable that he wants to try to stop the war and bring parties to the negotiating table. But Ursula von der Leyen accused him of appeasement. So she said, this is no peace mission. This is plain appeasement, by which she's insinuating, you know, that, you know, Viktor Orban, maybe he's not Hitler, but he's at the very least, he's, you know, Neville Chamberlain. And, by implication, you know, Vladimir Putin is Hitler again, and any kind of peace between Ukraine and Russia would then be introduction to another world war on the European continent. I think this is a very misguided rhetoric and very dangerous rhetoric, but it shows us that there's a network of power in charge, both in the United States and in Europe, that still want war, that don't want peace positively, and that they want Ukraine to continue fighting, even at the cost of complete destruction of Ukraine and sacrifice of every last Ukrainian man, woman, and child.
One of the major issues in Europe would be their economy right now. And if Trump wins, in your opinion, is their economy getting anywhere better than it is right now?
European economy.
Yeah.
No, I think that European economies, I don't want to use the word doom. That's maybe a little bit too strong, but it's definitely in a downtrend. And I think that that downtrend is deliberate. The European economies are being deindustrialized, they're being deliberately immiserated. Social pressure is being applied to the population. And I think it's part of the agenda to fashion European nations like Poland, Germany, France, and others like Romania, Bulgaria, and so forth into the next beachheads against Russia. And, immiserating a society creates the dry tinder for polarization, where you can then say, oh, this is all Russia's fault, and we really need to fight Russia because they are the ones who are destroying our economies and our societies. This is exactly what was done in Ukraine after 2014. This is exactly what was done in Germany during the 1930s. And an additional piece of evidence in favor of that hypothesis is that between 1991, so the collapse of the Soviet Union, and 2014, when there was a coup in Ukraine, only five nations in the world registered negative GDP growth over that 24-year period. And three of those nations were exactly the nations that were being prepared as bludgeons against Russia. And there were Ukraine, the worst economic performer in the world. Second one was Moldova, and the third one was Georgia. So those three nations were among five only nations in the whole world that had negative GDP growth between 1991 and 2014, all of them by applying IMF's structural reforms. So it seems to me that this is a deliberate ploy, and that today is being applied in Europe. Again, I think with a view of turning Europe into a, militarizing and Nazifying Europe for the next go against Russia.
Yeah, there is an article in The Economist. It says that China is building up huge secret reserves of food, raw materials, and energy resources in preparation for possible future problems. And do you think that China is preparing for the worst in Taiwan or even in Ukraine because they're helping Russia? And how do you see the way that China is behaving right now?
I think that China is behaving in a reasonable, constructive way as a grown-up at the table. As far as the Economist goes, I trust them about as far as I could throw them. It's very easy to misrepresent normal economic policy as something sinister, as something nefarious. Of course, a country that has certain issues with food supplies, with which requires raw materials for their economy, and fears maybe economic sanctions in the future, similar as they were applied to Russia, they might want to stock up on critical commodities and foodstuffs. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily preparing to take on the world, to invade Taiwan and wage war against the United States. If we know anything about China, is that they are very, very unlikely to go to war, and they try to do everything they can to avoid it. If a war is imposed on them, then obviously it's a different thing. But I think it's perhaps the responsible approach of prepare for the worst and hope for the best, or work for the best. And The Economist is part of the Western press that likes to galvanize situations, that likes to create fear and hysteria, and that likes to demonize the let's say, uppity powers that are not keen on following the Western diktat. I would take whatever they write with a grain of salt. And I think if we look at the historical track record of China and of the conduct of its foreign policy, it's always been reasonable and constructive, and I see no reason why that should change at this point.
And the other important news that I think it's so interesting is the BRICS announced an alternative to SWIFT. And this is huge for the countries who have a lot of problems. Even Russia has problems with SWIFT right now. And if they can overcome this difficulty, how can it be translated in their economy?
Well, I think it will just make the trade that much easier. SWIFT is SWIFT is not this big mysterious thing that cannot be duplicated. It's simply a messaging system, who pays what to whom, and so the money flows from let's say if I'm buying something and my payment flows from my balance to somebody else's balance, whoever sold me those goods. And so that obviously requires some form of a standard message format. So, the Russians have already created their own. The Chinese have also created their own. And so I think that making those systems available or developing a common one is a simple step to allow countries to trade between themselves and to use their own currencies in that trade. I think this is part of the endeavor to overcome the limitations that everybody was working under, it being having to use US dollars and SWIFT and different countries' US dollar balances at the Federal Reserve Bank or European banks that hold euro dollar balances for trading nations, or euros and yen to the extent that they serve as trading currencies. This allowed Western nations to impose sanctions on other countries like Venezuela to make it very difficult for them to export their goods and get paid, and to use those balances to procure the goods that they need to import because they don't. They don't produce them domestically. And so the ability to simply manage those payment flows simply lubricates the trade that is then which then cannot be cut off by Western sanctions. So I think that's the whole point of that infrastructure. And it's going to go and be developed regardless of Western officials throwing their tantrums and Western bankers wishing to undo that and live in the delusional world where they control everything. That's gone and it's not coming back ever.
Did you see Netanyahu's visit to the United States? On one hand, he's talking about war and going to war with Hezbollah, with Iran. On the other hand, we had China and Russia trying to bring, China brought these various groups in Palestine together to make some sort of agreement. And on the other hand, Russia is trying to bring Bashar al-Assad and Erdogan together. It seems that the world is changing hugely in the Middle East as well. And the way that they're trying to bring everybody together to make some sort of solution in Gaza, what's going on in Gaza. How do you find the United States foreign policy right now? How Netanyahu can influence their policy in order to make new wars even with Iran?
It seems to me that he can't. I think this is all bluster and narrative control. Iran cannot defeat Hamas. Israeli Defense Force has been crystal clear in a report they submitted to the Israeli cabinet that taking on Hezbollah would be suicidal, that they stand no chance against Hezbollah. They cannot control the Houthis in Yemen. And to take on Iran would be absolutely suicidal. It would be, I think it would be the end of Iran, and it would be the end of Western hegemony
The end of
in the Middle
Israel, you
East.
mean?
Yes, I think it would be the end of Israel. But you know, that shouldn't be such a shocking statement, because even before this war, even before October 7, 23, we had Henry Kissinger on record in 2012 saying, 10 years from now, there will be no Israel. Henry Kissinger knew a thing or two about the Middle East and Israel and about the balance of forces there. And maybe he missed the timeline. So he was saying that by 2022, there wouldn't be any Israel any longer. We're in 2024, but you know, his prediction is probably correct. His timeline was maybe too short. But I think that there is simply no possibility for Western powers in any combination to take on Iran and to prevail and to reinforce their hegemony in the Middle East rather than lose it. They're going to get squeezed out completely if they try that. And I think that people at the Pentagon understand this, and I think that they're not going to be as foolhardy as attempting it. The neocons in Washington, D.C., they might like to talk about it. They might like to sound tough. They might like to issue threats and try to intimidate Iran into making some kind of a fatal mistake. But it's very unlikely that anything like that is going to happen. Let's not forget, 3 years ago, the United States had to leave Afghanistan with their tail between their legs, defeated by Taliban, you know, figuratively speaking, goat herders in sandals wielding AK-47s. Iran is a major regional power. It's a formidable military, and they've been preparing for a showdown with the United States and NATO for 30 years now. This is not going to be something that the United States can even dream about prevailing in.
The other important thing is how Iran is connected with China and Russia. We have new projects between Iran and Russia, a gas project, which is huge. And even India has. And when it comes to the conflict with Iran, that would bring all of these players in, and their interests are in Iran. And this would make a huge mistake on the part of the United States if it decides to go after some sort of conflict with Iran.
Yes, absolutely. It would be a huge mistake. And you know, the cooperation between Russia and Iran, China and Iran, even Saudi Arabia and Iran is only getting more and more serious. Iran signed a comprehensive cooperation agreements with Russia and China. They're cooperating on these are extremely big developments. They are working on developing Iran's natural gas capacity. I think that the Chaluz field in the north of Iran has a capacity of supplying something like 50% of European demand for natural gas for the next 20 years at least. And you see companies like Gazprom and Transneft and Iranian and Chinese companies cooperating on that. They're at the same time building the North-South International Transport Corridor between the Persian Gulf and India, up to all the way up to St. Petersburg, and from there possibly to Northern and Eastern Europe. You see Russian, Chinese, and Iranian navies holding regular drills in the Indian Ocean off the, you know, just outside of the entrance to Persian Gulf, signal being there. There's powerful forces here. We can cut this flow of resources any day, and there's nothing you can do about it to the Western powers. And so I think not only have the leaders of all these countries understood the playbook of Western powers, which is let's blow things up, divide and conquer, let's foment color revolution, let's destabilize different regimes. And you can see them failing more and more and more. We now have the prosperity guardian in the Red Sea in what they've been there for nearly 6 months or so, and they still cannot control Ansar Allah in Yemen. And we know that since the early 1990s, the Pentagon has circulated these policy papers in which they said, well, actually, our hegemony in the Middle East depends on two things: A, projecting power, meaning bluffing, basically, and B, relying on our allies, meaning, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and countries like this. But all of that has fallen apart. They can no longer project power because everybody can see that they don't have the power to project, and all their alliances have kind of fallen apart, or are on very, very thin ice. So it's only a matter of time when they will be completely squeezed out of the region, and they will have to either recede into a block, into some kind of an autarky at home, or they will have to, rejoin the world in as a one of the members of the international community on a constructive and equitable basis, and trade rather than go around, build military bases, and conquer other people's resources.
When you look at the way that Zelensky is trying to put pressure on Orban and Fico, and do you think who gave Zelensky, who has given Zelensky the green light to do that, is the United States or European Union is part of this?
No, I think there's no question that the European Union is a part of it. But I would say that the axis of evil there is between Wall Street and the City of London, and then they control the policy in ways that are obviously not spelled out for us to understand. But we can see that recently Zelensky received a delegation of bankers, which included representatives of JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs and BlackRock and so forth. They are the ones who are most interesting in Ukraine. And then you have also US politicians who sometimes run their mouth and they explain to us what it's all about. Namely, what was it, a few weeks ago? It was Lindsey Graham who said that, oh, we have to hold on to Ukraine because there's $12 trillion worth of natural resources that belongs to us. That's ours. We have to keep it. That's what it's all about. They absolutely do not care about democracy in Ukraine. They absolutely do not care whether all Ukrainians end up dead in the process of fighting this war for them. They simply want Ukraine for as their beachhead against Russia. They want Ukrainian resources. And again, the group in society which cares most about controlling resources by force, meaning as opposed to by fair trade, are the bankers. And so we have to look to City of London and Wall Street. And let's not forget that it was in November 2021, I think, when the Boris Johnson gave a speech in the City of London in which he announced the war in Ukraine, when he said that, warning the Europeans, he said that, and I have to warn our European friends that soon the time will come to choose between mainlining Russian hydrocarbons through giant oil pipelines and gas pipelines, or standing up for freedom and democracy in Ukraine. That speech happened in the City of London, So I think I it does seem to me that the strategic and let's say philosophical headquarters of this empire is still the City of London. And then, the Wall Street and Washington, D.C. are satellites, as is the EU, and they all play along. But I think that the main the main force there, main axis is the financial cartel in the City of London and Wall Street.
And do you see Ukraine with the current situation that they're having right now being part of the EU, or it's all gone? It's not possible for
No,
the EU.
Nima, they will never be part of the EU, and I think it was never intended for them to be part of the EU. Ukraine was strung along for more than 20 years in various EU-Ukraine accession summits. I think this was going, I think they held more than 20 summits over 20 years, in which they just kept stringing the Ukrainians along, like, yeah, you will become a member of the EU, you will become a member of the EU. But they would always find something, oh, you have to improve your judicial system, oh, you have to improve human rights record, oh, you have to make your media free, oh, you have to sell off the agricultural land and so forth. And Ukrainians always try to satisfy all the conditions, but then the Europeans will always find some other reason why it couldn't be done. And this all happened all the way until that fateful November of 2021, when when they finally gave Yanukovych EU accession agreement to sign, but he couldn't sign it because the cost of Ukraine signing that agreement was estimated to be $160 billion to Ukraine. And the Europeans were refusing to help Ukraine with funding this $160 billion. And so Yanukovych didn't refuse. He said, well, we need to continue talking because we cannot afford this. Well, then they launched the color revolution on the back of this, saying like, oh, he's refusing to sign this because Putin put pressure on him. This is not how it happened at all. But basically, from Croatian experience and from the experience of all the Eastern European countries that became NATO members, the membership in the EU was always dangled as a carrot to all these nations to first become members of the NATO. And so out of 11 nations, out of 11 Eastern European nations who became EU members, all 11 of them first had to become members of NATO. And only once they became members of NATO were they allowed to join the European Union. And I think that the same carrot was dangled in front of Ukraine, but without really them intending ever to allow Ukraine to actually join. This was just a lure for them to become a NATO member, to go to war for Russia, for Western interests, and all of that for this elusive promise of future prosperity, which, by the way, none of us got. Croatia became a member of the EU, I think, in 2000. Sorry, in a member of NATO, I think, in 2008. We were allowed to join the European Union in 2013. Believe me, we're not any better off for it. Things haven't improved even a slight little bit, except that now we're on the hook that maybe if there's a big war against Russia, maybe European sorry, Croatian soldiers might have to go and fight Russia, even though we have no quarrel with Russia whatsoever.
The other thing, Alex, recently Joseph Borrell reported that more than 70% of energy facilities in Ukraine have been destroyed. And on the other hand, we recently learned that more than 700,000 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in this battle, more than 2 years. In your opinion, when you look at Ukraine, the current situation of Ukraine, how long does it take if tomorrow they decide to go after some sort of negotiations? How long does it take to bring Ukraine back on the track?
I think it's hard to say, but my estimate would be probably about 20 years. And I don't mean that as, like the improvements will probably begin as soon as some kind of an armistice is signed. Probably at this point it's going to be a capitulation of the current regime in Ukraine, and they're going to have to turn over control over pretty much the whole country to the Russians, not militarily. I don't think that the Russian troops are going to sweep all across Ukraine, but at least, you know, places like Kharkov, Kiev, Odessa, they're going to be administratively taken over by the Russians. And I think at that point, and there's already been extensive talks about this, there's going to be Russian and Chinese investments that are going to flow into Ukraine. Obviously, the first thing they're going to have to repair is the infrastructure, the electricity grid, and the transport system, and then they're going to begin to develop agriculture and heavy industries. You know, the improvements are going to start very, very quickly. Probably something on a tempo that we've seen in places like Mariupol. You know, where people's homes are going to get repaired, the electricity grid is going to be repaired, people are going to get back their transport, communications, internet, all of these things. But for Ukraine to recover economically, I think it might take probably a decade or two at least. And I think that in 20 years from now, we're going to be looking at a completely different situation. You know, Ukraine is going to be again a prosperous nation, much more so than it has been at any point since its independence in 1991, but it's going to be a gradual process. Obviously, it's going to be helped by Russia and by China primarily, so maybe that's going to speed things up a little bit, but it's a long process, you know, rebuilding the heavy industries, the oil pipelines, the gas pipelines, the agricultural production, and so forth. You know, that's going to take some years.
Yeah, you mean that the bright future for Ukraine would be with Russia, not without Russia?
Yeah, you can put it that way, but I would put it not so much Russia, but the multipolar integrations, the Belt and Road Initiative, Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, in which Ukraine plays a very important role, potentially, you know. It cannot be done today because, you know, Zelensky government is still under the tutelage of CIA and MI6. But once this element is purged from the Kiev government and they lose their power over Ukraine, then Ukraine is going to become one of the components of the Belt and Road Initiative, and from that point on, its development is going to be much more favorable than anything that the West can offer today. And let's not forget, the West has been either controlling Ukraine or had critical, you know, decisive influence in Ukraine pretty much since 1991. You know, NATO went in very quickly. They already had a strategic partnership agreement since 1997. George Soros and his Open Society Institute were there since before 1991. They were forming the so-called civil society and funding these NGOs. They took over the banking system. And the IMF enforced their structural reforms, always under the pretense that this is going to help Ukraine's development. But what Ukraine got from that is the worst economic performance of any country in the world between their independence in 91 and the coup in 2014. So obviously, it doesn't take much to do better than this. You know, I think that, I don't know, my kids, if they were in charge of Ukraine, would probably do better.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today. Great pleasure,
always,
as always.
Always a pleasure, Nima. Thank you.
See you soon. Bye-bye.